Hello, and welcome to Letters from the Lunchroom, a podcast by Communities and Schools of Mid-America. I'm your host, Victoria Partridge. Communities and Schools is a nationwide nonprofit which connects students and their families to local resources in order to remove barriers so that they will have greater success in school and in life. During this podcast, we talk to people who have a relationship with our organization. From students to staff members and alumni to volunteers, we know that people who connect with nonprofits have a story that led them there, and we want to know that story. Today, we are talking with Ray Saldana, President and CEO of Communities and Schools National. Please join us as Ray shares what it was like stepping into a leadership role at the start of a pandemic, how he is connecting with CIS affiliates across the nation, and what he would say if given 2 minutes with the incoming presidential administration. Hello and welcome to the lunchroom, Ray. How are you doing today?
I'm doing very good. Thank you. I hope you're well.
I am doing well as well. Would you please take a moment and introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is Ray Saldana. I am the president and CEO of Communities and Schools, and I've certainly worn a lot of hats, but as the leader of a national nonprofit that functions all across the country, this is one that has certainly been, an experience of a lifetime. It certainly has been the last several months.
Well, certainly. And we're actually just going to jump right into talking about your role as the leader of this national organization. So you stepped into this role just days before the pandemic shut down our country and closed down school buildings. What was that like coming into this role during that time of crisis?
You know, there is I often think about I'm a big fan of history and particular persons in history, and so I'm a big fan of Robert Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy, his writings, his speeches, and I can recall listening to one of his speeches he gave in the early 60s about, it was actually a speech that he gave to the people of South Africa. It was the Day of Affirmation, and in this speech, speaking to the times and the moment, was sort of in a call to action, had a phrase that really functions almost as if you are cursing a generation, that may you live in interesting times, is the line. And at the moment in the 60s, that was a time of turmoil and protest and civil unrest all across the country. And sort of coming into that, I knew that I wanted to come into this role because it was going to be a challenge. And when you are asked to, in my case, lead a national nonprofit that is working on as varied issues as, you know, our roots around dropout prevention, but at its core, building relationships with students and helming this organization at a moment where disconnecting or falling out of connection with those students because of the pandemic was something that I figured, well, we certainly are living through interesting times, and this is absolutely going to be a challenge coming into this role. But it was I think looking back, you know, the best way to be battle tested is to go through battle. And there are so many fights that I think are worthy of taking up. And if you think about our organization, which is now 43 years into its existence, but absolutely had its roots in the early 60s at a time that Bobby Kennedy was proclaiming, may you live in interesting times, to particularly the youth and how they and their movement and their generation would rise to the challenge. I see that in a similar way for our network, and I certainly feel like we have had the gauntlet throw down at a moment in time where our students, and particularly our students of color and those living in poverty or communities of low income that have been ravished by this global pandemic, it feels like the way to get through this is to do it in a way that is unified. So it's really been, for me, being at the right place at the right time, thinking through how this has brought our network and the most valuable asset we have, which is our site coordinators who work in schools and have actually built relationships that they have stood on when, you know, they've shifted and pivoted their work, not just inside the school building, but now outside, meeting students and their families where they are. So it has been an exciting challenge, and certainly one that feels personal to me as when I close my eyes and envision the families and what they're going through, feeling like we're all trying to do our part, and getting to lead at a moment like this is an incredible honor.
Well, and also personal to you, because you were a former student who was once supported by this organization. And so because of that experience, you bring a special perspective to the work. How has that influenced your vision for our network during this time?
Yeah, you know, I will say I get to wear the title or the position of leader and president and CEO of this organization, but the one I'm most proud of is to call myself an alumna, or alumnus of the program. And having met communities and schools, not as a national organization, not as a nonprofit, but as a relationship with my site coordinator, and her name was Ms. Gladys Reyes. And she represented CIS more than I knew anything about what the organization was or how far and the breadth of our reach. So I think going through this experience and understanding what it's like to stand on several years, decades in this case, of experience by my predecessors and the kinds of learning experiences that happen when you are tinkering with a system that allows you in. And when I say system, I mean the school system, our school partners, our principals who open their doors and say, we value what you do because you build relationships with students. I sort of see that through my own experience and through a lot of the alumni who I get to interact with, especially as I've been coming into this, trying to envision how our network really steps up in this moment. So I think the way that it has influenced me is it's given me the kind of perspective that has allowed an organization of our size that is a national one to try to come together to lean in on one another. And I say that specifically because if you were to do a case study of organizations that have been around as long as we have, who serve as many students, who are in as varied geographics as, you know, rural West Virginia to urban Chicago, there are ways that somebody who is at the position of leadership at the national office can get, you know, far away from the work and forget what it's like to truly be on the ground serving students and living the mission and asking yourselves why you do what you do. So that is, I think, something that this moment in time is giving us now as we are learning new ways to adapt to the challenges that our students are facing. And for me, has been a gift that I can trade those kinds of examples with the leaders that we have all across the network.
So you just mentioned, you know, trying to avoid that separation by going out there and seeing the work, being, you know, in the experience. And ordinarily, as a CEO, a new CEO, you likely would have traveled extensively during the first few months to go and meet folks in our network and really see that work in action and essentially go out, you know, and be on the ground. So how have you been able to get out there and really see the work for yourself in this new virtual environment?
Yeah, well, I'll say that I kick myself because I still have a bag packed and it is in my closet. I'm still here where I was born and raised, actually. So it's a gift that I spent a little more time near family in San Antonio, Texas. But in my best hope coming in March, which was the same week that everybody across the country was really shutting down and telling their employees to work from home, I had imagined that would be a 2 or 3 week timeline, but my bags are still packed. I played baseball growing up, and I was always very superstitious about what preparations before the game. So I've still not unpacked that bag. It'll stay there until I get up to visit the many members of the network. So in the interim, what I've been able to do, actually, it's kind of this wonderful experience that all of us have adapted to, which is to go from a morning that starts in Atlanta, and then in you know, an hour after I'm presenting to the board in Atlanta, I'm talking to friends in CIS of Los Angeles, or in CIS of Washington, or in Ohio. And I do not believe, without a lot of exhaustion and a lot of air miles, I would have been able to have garnered that kind of experience, because in many ways, I would certainly be up for taking as many of these meetings as possible. But the time that it takes for these organizations, then I hate to be a burden on them to, you know, welcome in a the visiting CEO, and how sometimes we have to get things ready. This is great because I do it with a click of a button. But I will say it does irk at me sometimes, because I even when I, previous to my role as CEO of CIS, I was serving in local elected office, and I never liked being in my office at City Hall when I was a city councilman in San Antonio. I liked riding along with our public works crew, filling potholes, or with our police officers, or with our animal resource officers who were patrolling the streets. And that is something that is hard to do because of the circumstances. And I think in a small way, the silver lining is I'm able to interact with many more of our network, and they have shared with me the kinds of experiences that they're going through. And it, like I said, has brought us together in a new way. So I'm appreciative of that. And my bag is packed and I'm ready to go as soon as the green light is opened up for us to start traveling again.
Oh, looking forward to that. So we just spoke a little bit about how the pandemic has affected the beginning of your work here with us, and kind of forced you into a virtual environment. You've likely heard many, many stories about the impact of the pandemic and the racial reckoning that's been happening in our country on the lives of our students. Is there a particular story that stands out in your mind?
Yeah, and you've mentioned two, you know, big shifts in the last 10 months, one of which, of course, is the pandemic, and the other is the social unrest with a lack of confronting the important issues around race, the important issues around discrimination that are built into the very DNA and the bones of the institutions and structures that make up this country. And when I say systems and I say institutions, I mean everything from not just public schools, but to our justice system, to the way that we move capital and who has access to capital. So we are confronting a great deal to again, use the line, and living through these interesting times, we need to step into these challenges. I will say this example really sticks out to me about how difficult this can be for our students. I was on a call with the Communities and Schools of Laredo. They are a small city on the border of Texas and Mexico. And they had invited an alumni to come speak to their board. It was an event where they were getting to know the experience of what happens with our students after they leave. And one of our students was coming through on Zoom. And she did a wonderful job. She described the example of having half her family in Mexico, half her family in the U.S., being stuck and not able to travel to see them. But what was most compelling was by the end of it, they asked her where she was doing her interview. And she said she was doing it at the site of the home where her mother was cleaning, because she didn't have, you know, she was traveling with her mother and they didn't have internet at home. So she asked the person whose house her mother was cleaning if she could access a computer and a Wi-Fi connection. And she was doing it while her mother was cleaning, and just kind of tells you a little bit about the sort of resiliency and the uniqueness and just the compelling grit that you have to have as a, you know, student facing not just the normal conditions of what life can be like without having the rocks thrown at you that has happened over the last 10 months. And so that was a gripping one. And the other around the racial reckoning was how CIS of Atlanta students were really taking heart to what they can do themselves, and led the entire, you know, CIS alumni network in Atlanta out on the streets in protest and wrote grippingly about their experience. And I thought that was something that moved our entire Communities and Schools network, not just CIS of Atlanta. And it was something that had to happen. And that those are two examples that stick out in my head.
It's so inspirational to hear of our young people standing up for what they believe in. So I'm glad you shared that.
Yeah.
So this past summer, you emphasized the need for the CIS network, and indeed anyone involved in education, to be prepared to focus on student re-engagement as kids returned to learning. For folks who might not understand what you mean about re-engagement, can you say more?
Yeah, absolutely. And it speaks to what it looks like to add, you know, improve on the design, improve on the model, improve on what we know works for young students and our site coordinators who are interacting with them. Because the concept of re-engagement is what does it mean to do more than just ask, how are you doing, and be satisfied when that young person or their family says, we're okay. Going deeper and beyond the I'm okay or I'm fine means that we are preparing our site coordinators and they are training their schools and school leaders on what it looks like to get beyond the I'm doing okay to the real, what's really at the surface of what could have been the trauma, the impact, the lingering effects of having been taken away from school or your access to food or your stable living situation. And for us, re-engagement means that we are looking at a different unit of measure. When we talk about our work at CIS, oftentimes, and even in my case, as an alumni, I'm a data point of a student who, you know, did well. And sometimes the unit of measure is how well can we get this student to navigate the difficult challenges that the current system is putting in front of our young people. To think about a different unit of measure, the unit of measure is now, how well can we impact this school and the conditions of the school to ensure that we are removing the kinds of obstacles that students, not just the ones we're working in a one-on-one basis with, but everybody attending that school can benefit from. It means our site coordinators, when they are thinking through re-engagement strategies and tools that change the way we interact and talk with our students and their families, that they are truly creating equitable conditions for learning around the physical environment of the school, the physical environment of what conditions are necessary for families who are struggling with an eviction notice and or just access to basic needs, that is something that is felt and addressed by the entire school and leadership and not just the site coordinator for a very specific population of students. That there are tools that we want to put in the hands of our site coordinators, their training that we want to provide at the national office, and in the most honest of ways, we're all still learning how to do this best. So the first version will be our ability to re-engage students and walk them through measures of social emotional engagement, because we've been very good at working with our partners on measuring absenteeism, behavior conditions. But when it comes to social emotional learning, we're still just scratching the surface. And re-engagement means that we are connecting with our students and their families and our schools in a new way.
Well, and I think that there's nothing wrong with, you know, sort of like quote unquote admitting that we are learning and we're all just trying to do our best, because just like the CIS model, we are constantly monitoring and adjusting our services and supports. And so I think that's part of the learning process. And so I kind of want to dig into what you were saying a little bit more and get some more details. What would you say our site coordinators are currently doing differently, and how does it look to the student, the teacher, and to the parents that we serve?
For one, I will say that the way it looks different has been an added benefit, because going through this experience has taught us a great deal around how much involvement is necessary when we are working with families. And so because the normal interaction of our site coordinators with our young people, with students, had been in a classroom within the four walls, the pandemic has forced us all out of that atmosphere. And for us, we didn't just say, I guess, can't continue doing our work since I can't see the student in the classroom. It has meant that our site coordinators have been knocking on doors, that they have learned the process of what it's like to get an answer at the door that says, sorry, they don't live here anymore. We've turned into almost investigators on the last known location or the friend, or they were seen at a neighbor's home. So you might want to check in with these. I think they are, for us as site coordinators, it's taken us out of a zone of comfort that has only really taught us more about what we can do to approach the whole student. And that's an academic term about whole child supports, but now it's looking more like whole family supports, specifically because of everything, or at least the examples I have seen from site coordinators across the network in Los Angeles or in Dallas or in Houston, where they're helping families navigate access to federal dollars that are coming down in the form of stimulus. And many of our families who don't know how to navigate or jump through the hoops to access those, they call them EBT dollars, which allow them to buy groceries. That puts our families at a real disadvantage. So we've now learned how to interact with families in a new way when it was just a sort of interaction with students. So specifically, we're learning new ways to go beyond the classroom and truly meet the needs of our students. So coming back through this experience, our ability to measure that level of impact with families is going to be critical, especially because now we are understanding, again, the social emotional learning aspects, all those non-academic factors that need to be true for students can be measured, can be put through the prism of surveys with families. And I just want to pull out one example, because we're working with the American Institute of Research, which are the experts who have been talking about how critical social emotional learning is for the last three decades. But I would say it's only been in the last 3 years that educators and policymakers have really been paying attention to how critical the measurement of social emotional engagement has to be for us to get the learning right with our teachers and our curriculum. And David Osher is one of the experts who works at the American Institute of Research, providing some of our site coordinators. When I talk about tools, here's one. It's an assessment survey that in normal circumstances should take about 10 minutes to walk through with a student and their family on how they're engaging with their community, what they need, how life has been turned upside down. That should take about 10 minutes. The early reports on this is that it is taking some of our site coordinators close to an hour to get through that survey, because what it does is it opens up an avenue that a family can then walk into and start really uncovering the issues that are really at the core of why their students are not showing up to virtual learning or why they may be struggling. And I think more than anything, it brings us back to the original mission of communities and schools, is that it's not programs that change people's lives, it's relationships. So what can we put into the hands of our professionals to help them build stronger relationships? And because we've been doing that with students, we've learned a thing or two over the last four decades. Now we're learning how to do that with the families, who are incredibly important to our measures of success and impact.
Excellent. So throughout this conversation, you've mentioned a couple of the CIS affiliates that are located across this country. What lessons are you learning from our affiliates as they walk through this new journey with students, parents, and the community when it comes to recovering, re-engaging, and reimagining the future of education?
Well, they are doing and teaching in exactly the way that you would assume when given the flexibility to become creative. They are stepping into the gaps of this notion that this pandemic has exacerbated the distinctions, that the differences between those who have and those who have not. And I think they've pushed us all to talk about what we are doing for students in terms of systems. And again, to this point, that what we are good at when we are working with students and we have a caseload to manage is when we are assigned a student and they have issues, we can, like a scalpel, really dissect what the issues are that are confronting that individual student and what barriers we can help them jump over so that they can reach their potential and their success. But I think what the site coordinators and many of the executive directors are teaching us, and some moving faster than others, are really calling to question the institution of public education and how it is wrongly built for the majority of our students, where if you are honest with history and honest with the creation of how public education came to this country, it's that it was not built to manage the level of poverty that we are seeing in classrooms. And I'm remembering a statistic that the snapshot of students who were living and suffering through poverty as measured by free and reduced lunch in the late 80s was about 32% of the total makeup of public schools. In 2016, that crossed the threshold to 51% and only growing and becoming more and more of an issue. So if we truly want to rebuild schools, which is the system that communities and schools has a sphere of influence in, then we need to talk about the architecture of our schools. Because if you were to compare a school with a communities and schools site coordinator to one that didn't, you would say that one of those schools is more just than the other. It is more capable of reaching the needs of the most vulnerable than the other. And it's this constant evolution of the public education system that is natural to our history. It used to be that public schools didn't provide free lunch until the mid to late 60s, where that program was implemented in a universal way. So in the same way that we think about how critical it is to have a hot meal at school, that's how important and not nice to have, but essential, a trained site coordinator who is impacting the school level data, but also the individual schools is critical. So we say that our vision is to have a site coordinator in every Title I school in America. And if you squinted and pictured the future, there are 80,000 Title I schools, and we are the largest provider of what we call wraparound services or integrated student supports. We're at this point in 2,800 of those 81,000 schools. We have work to do, and we don't think this is all a CIS play. We think we can help train those, and we can help create new opportunities for others who are doing the kind of work that we do, because there's unfortunately plenty to go around for students who are suffering without an advocate or a caring relationship with an adult.
So I know that a lot of our conversation has kind of centered around the pandemic, and it's not surprising to anybody listening because that is what 2020 has sort of been defined by. So we're going to continue on with that. So given what we experienced in the spring and what we are now learning in the fall, what is the short list of things, a policy, a strategy, an expectation that you think will become part of the best practices for education, even when the pandemic is behind us?
When I say that we are living through this moment in time, and I sort of think through what it would feel like in a few years to look back and say, did we take advantage of a moment to truly rethink the way we had been doing things? I think it would be a shame on us moment if we didn't attack this policy strategy that we have at CIS. And I will say policy strategy because, again, we're thinking in ways of systems and what truly needs to be true within the architecture of a school for us to be a just system, that when we say something like having a site coordinator for Title I school in the country, means that there are certain tactics we need to take to ensure that those individuals, because again, there is not an army of trained site coordinators who also have specialties in social work. There is not an army standing around of individuals ready to deploy. Those individuals that CIS has really been training on the model, they make up a small majority of the larger army that needs to be created to impact these schools, backed by evidence, but also supported along the way as well. And there is, I think, a big movement to ensure that every school has this ingredient, but it will take work at the state levels. And we have seen some success in states like North Carolina or in Texas, even in Ohio, where they have gotten the notion that this is the non-academic factors in facing a student are just as critical as the academic ones. And if we care about standardized test scores and we care about the success of our student, that what we should truly consider is both of those elements need to be supported, not just the academics, but the non-academic factors and those individuals who are helping our students overcome them. So we think there's a support system at the state level. There's evidence on how we can lobby some of our policymakers and legislators. Even now, as we speak, and we're thinking through the transition of a federal administration and a new president, we think that there is an opportunity for the new administration to truly take on this call. They have a slogan in the new administration called Build to Better. we know that schools are not built to their best, and we know that there are components that are missing. It really will be about the willpower and our ability to tell our story around evidence and data and a track record that I think positions this organization to grow, so that I hope in 5 years we're getting to see the vision come to life, which will mean a lot of work for many of our networks who are being called the experts in their communities, being called the experts with partners who are superintendents and principals that we've worked with.
So you brought up the new administration. So let's take a moment and just pivot briefly to the election. Why was it important for CIS to encourage our voting age students and alumni to participate in the voting process?
The important benefit of being an organization of our size is the kind of clout that we have, but also the breadth and reach of students, site coordinators, who are living in the communities that are often impacted the most by neglect. And when we think through it, I certainly consider in my previous life as an elected official at the local level, when we think of why it is that year after year, decade after decade, sometimes we feel like nothing changes. I can recall when I was serving as a city councilman, knocking on doors and coming to the realization that what I was actually doing when I was knocking on doors, campaigning, is that I was going to the very same doors that the previous candidate had gone through. And I was skipping just about, if there were 10 houses down a block, I would knock on two and skip the rest of the eight. That there is tremendous harm you can do to a community when you completely overlook and neglect and don't knock on their doors to say, I'm here to work for you. I'm not here just to work for the status quo. And so when you think about the asset that Communities and Schools has working in the majority communities, rural, urban, and suburban, that are oftentimes overlooked, there is strength in numbers in being recognized as a source of power, that what would happen if you could shift beyond just the who is being elected, whether that is your president, that is your mayor, or your state senator. What will happen is that when people get into power, they will often look out into the world and find out, where are those pockets of neighborhoods? Where are those communities? Where are those constituencies where we truly can't neglect or ignore? Because if we do, we will feel it in the next election. That is the strength that I think was behind the concept of trying to ensure that our students, our site coordinators, were, you know, essentially turning the lights on in their neighborhood by being recognized as having voted, that we want to be counted, that we want to be respected, that we want our concerns heard. And oftentimes what happens is we'll allow an election to go by and curse the darkness, but still live in the darkness because we're not necessarily using our voice. And it reminds me of this great bumper sticker. I live in Texas, and so if you believe in something strong enough, you'll put it on your bumper sticker. Mm-hmm. And there was a bumper sticker that said that bad politicians are elected by good people who don't vote. Mm-hmm. And I believe that. I think that everybody, regardless of your political affiliation, your ideology, should at least vote because that says something and it allows you to be recognized. So I thought that was important for us. And I was afraid to get pushback, but I think the network embraced it in the most beautiful of ways. So I'm grateful.
Well, and I don't think it was all our doing, but we did see one of the largest turnouts ever in this year's election. So great for everybody for getting out and voting. If you had the chance to advocate to the new administration for a necessary change when it comes to serving the educational needs of students, what would you advocate for?
You know, the magic wand question is an important one. And there is again, this notion that advocating for communities and schools is a kind of advocacy that goes beyond just our nonprofit, just our organization, and looks to the the entire field of integrated student supports, which is the wraparound services that we have been deploying in communities all across the country. So if I had my 2 or 3 minutes with the administration, I would advocate for, of course, the resources to deploy as many of those site coordinators as possible into the communities where we are currently serving, and have that leveraged and supported by those states that have already understood that this is the right bet to make. That if we support our teachers, if we support our principals, and most importantly, if we support our students, we will ensure that their needs that go beyond just the academics or the curriculum, that those non-academic concerns, whether those around food or shelter or access to housing, access to the resources in college, resource coordinators, a lot of these assets exist in our communities. The problem, I would say, Mr. President, is that oftentimes you need a PhD to navigate the resources that exist in your community when you need help. We need an advocate for the students. In our case, those are called site coordinators, and we think that they should be in every Title I school in the country. And so I think that would be, you know, how I'd spend my pitch or proposal. There's a lot of ways to skin the cat when you come through the legislative process, but I think that's the important one, is putting some resources behind deploying that army, because that's the only way to win a war.
Yeah, absolutely. So now, as you look ahead to 2021, what's on the agenda for communities and schools?
This is an exciting one. I say that because I've gotten enough assurances from leadership throughout communities and schools, executive directors who have been working in the organization for decades. It's around our support of our alumni. We have a mission statement. That mission statement says that we are going to build a system of supports to ensure students succeed in school and achieve in life. It's that second part that I think is going to be a decade's worth of work to build the kind of infrastructure that says we want to live up to that promise, that the students who want to continue to be connected and engaged with communities and schools because they need our support, that we will support them in their prospects to achieve in life, that we will empower them. Some of them may be looking towards the option of post-secondary, four-year college or community college. Some of them may have those aspirations, but just need to stabilize life and still need a continuation of support from a caring adult who can help them navigate what a workforce solution option looks like. Or some of them just may need some help around financial literacy or mental health supports because they're going through, you know, difficult times. That doesn't end when you cross the high school graduation stage. So I'm most excited about a vision where we are living up to our mission, and we're also never forgetting the important work we do K through 12 to get our students to that jumping point. But I think thinking through that transition bridge for our alumni is going to be an incredible journey for us as an organization, because we will naturally evolve to ask ourselves tough questions. And the tough question will be, are you living up to what you say? And I'm looking forward to the way that our network will continue to step up.
Oh, that's exciting. You've got me really looking forward to 2021 now. Well, Ray, I want to thank you for your time. I truly appreciate it, and for sharing all of this information regarding communities and schools and your role with us.
Thank you so much. And I really appreciate the fact that this is coming as an organic tool for us to communicate to not only the CIS family, but those who want to know more about the CIS family. So it's quite a treat. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us on this episode of Letters from the Lunchroom. For more information on communities and schools of Mid-America, please check out our website at cismidamerica.org. You can learn more about our national organization at communitiesandschools.org. Make sure to subscribe to this podcast, leave us a rating, and follow us on social media at CIS Mid-America. I'm your host, Victoria Partridge, and until next time, class is dismissed.